This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm interviewing Catherine Weber, the author of True Confections, which is a novel set in New Haven, Connecticut. Hi, Catherine. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm very well. It's a pleasure to talk to you. It is true that I have a personal connection to this book because I lived in New Haven for a long time, but hopefully not everyone who will come to read this book needs to have lived in New Haven in order to catch some of its layers of meaning. But maybe you could talk a little bit about the genesis. And maybe we'll sort of summarize where the book comes from. But it is a story about a family-owned candy company located in New Haven, Connecticut.
Zips Candies, makers since 1924 of Little Sammies, Mumbo Jumbos, and Tiger Melts, three candies inspired, for better or worse, by Little Black Sambo, which the founder, Eli Zaplinsky, had in his pocket when he ran away from New York City in a big hurry one day, for reasons that are somewhat explained in the novel. And this is someone who was a Hungarian immigrant, and he was teaching himself English from books he picked up in the children's library section at the Attendorfer Library in New York City.
And maybe stole one.
So he stole this one because he never went back. And so Little Black Sambo, which he did not recognize was not an American story, in fact, and was a horrifically racist story, he just took it at face value. And having been in the candy business and being inspired to make his own candies, he came up with the idea for three candies inspired by Little Black Sambo. And he ends up in New Haven, Connecticut, where after a little while he finds his feet and he opens a factory.
And, of course, the narrator of this story, which I think is an important thing to talk about, the narrator, and the whole book is told from her point of view, is Alice Tatnall Zaplinsky, who is not a Zaplinsky by birth, but a Zaplinsky by marriage.
She's an outsider insider, which is to say she's been involved with these people for 33 years, but she's never really been allowed all the way in, and she's not a Jew, although she tries very hard to get with the Zaplinskys and their customs. So the entire novel is actually a sort of crackpot affidavit, because there's dispute and the future of the factory is at issue and control of the factory is at issue. So if you were a Zaplinsky, the way you would characterize it is the shiksa who married in has taken over the family business, and she's struggling with her ex-sister-in-law, among others. But she was married to the heir to the Zips Candies fortune and business, Howard Zaplinsky, for 33 years, and has been just completely, deeply involved with the candy business as well as the Zaplinsky family.
Right. It seems like in some ways she's more involved than anybody else, and has maybe because she didn't have anything else in her life, or maybe because she needed something, she has cleaved to this family.
Yes, and in some ways, she brings a fresh energy to a business that every family business really could use it by the third or fourth generation, because traditionally, a family business, whether it's making candy or all kinds of other things, part of American 20th century history is the business that begins when the founder arrives from somewhere else with not much, maybe nothing, but ambition and ideas. And he creates something out of just about nothing and grows it. And then the next generation grows it significantly bigger, and it prospers and expands. But then by the third or fourth generation, there's a problem, which is people who are born into privilege, born into comfort, they're not born hungry, and they're not necessarily born very ambitious. And those people end up running a family business, and it's usually not very good for the business. So you have sometimes what I would call the idiot prince syndrome, where someone with no qualifications whatsoever, who would not be hired off the street, but because of blood, he ends up, running a business where the employees don't respect him. They might resent him. He thinks he hit a triple, but he was born on third base. And those people are very bad for a family business. They tend to either run it into the ground, or a wall, or sell out to a big company that wants to cherry pick their products or their brand name. Very rarely does a family business prosper beyond this point. But sometimes it can. If it's a big family, there are enough people where actually qualified people are in the family, as opposed to people who just, you know, get the business because it's their due. But then someone like Alice can come along, and she's the equivalent of first generation all over again. She has some of that energy and that ambition. She, in some ways, is much more of a spiritual heir to the original Hardscrabble founder than she is related to people born into this vat of candy. You know.
Well, of course, although, as you make clear, I think, in the book, she is the classic unreliable narrator.
Yes, she is.
Her view
she's crazy.
Of things. Well, she may be. I didn't feel that she
she's
was crazy.
Somewhat
but
crazy.
But she left clues some along the way. Things that her children said to her about her that she didn't really recognize as being critical of her, but had to somehow let them in.
Well, she leaves clues, but even before you get to her voice, I leave you a big clue. First of all, the title, True Confections, which is a gesture in the direction of true confessions. But also, let's talk about how true confections are. But the novel opens with a little quote from an Anne Sexton poem, which has the lines, "Even crazy, I'm as nice as a chocolate bar." So you have been warned.
Right, and it's clear that she has her own reason to tell this story the way she does. But there's a lot of love in her for specific people in the book.
And for the candy business.
Absolutely. She loves the business more than almost anybody else, except for the Eli.
The founder, who she never knew, and
right.
And her father-in-law, Sam.
Those
with
two.
Whom she has a true bond.
And actually, her mother-in-law, even though her mother-in-law resents her and doesn't think she really belongs in the family, in the end, she really appreciates, that is to say, Alice appreciates what her mother-in-law did to build the business.
Yes, and she has respect for her, begrudgingly.
Right. Now, you bring into this story, and I'm not going to, it's very important to me not to give away things in the story that readers might need to learn on their own, but there are some...
I appreciate that. Plot spoilers are just maddening, and I know people who won't read a book review because they're so afraid of coming across plot spoilers.
Well, for good reason. So we don't want to summarize the story, but you do bring in to the story some pretty interesting things. And early on in the book, so I don't think I'm giving it away, you find out that Alice is notorious for something that she did when she was young and foolish, perhaps.
Well, she accidentally burned something down and is known as arson girl because of bad advice from an attorney who had never done criminal defense. So she took a guilty plea. She was a kid. She was in high school. But it sticks to her.
Ooh,
and
ruins her life.
And it changes the course of her life, most certainly.
She doesn't get to go to college. Her parents, who are probably not the nicest people on earth, can't
they're
cope with it.
Pretty chilly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they're a nice contrast to the warm and, shall we say, quarrelsome Zaplinskys.
Yes, better the door slamming and the shouting and the fighting than the chilly silence of her ancestral origins.
And then there is the hint, and I'm not, again, we don't want to give too much away, but there's the hint that there might be another fire that this book has some reference to. So we won't talk about that, but more things happen that have to do with fire.
Yes, and the accumulation of information could cause you to begin to doubt her assertions going back. The further you get into her complete personal history, to tell the story of Zip's candies and her relationship to the Zaplinskys is also to tell her own life story.
Right, and also to establish it as true, whether other people agree with her or not. And so, in a sense, this is like a soliloquy.
Yes.
And where you get to make your own story because you're the teller.
Yes.
And there's no one here to disagree with you because you're the only voice.
And it's very important to her to be right. I think it would be safe to say she probably feels that she has more moral credibility than most everyone else in the story. And she has an insistent, really rather relentless need to explain everything. And so this is her shot at doing just that.
So in order to inhabit this character, which you obviously had to do for a long period of time, when you sat down to write every day or whenever you wrote, did you have to kind of put on a game face, you know, and kind of put yourself in character the way an actor does? How does that work?
That's a wonderful question. I'm not sure I could tell you something that's systematic and clear like that. But indeed, to write in a voice is an act. It's a thespian kind of writing or an act of role playing, certainly.
And hard to stay in character, I would think.
Yes, because you might have. I mean, I had a very thoroughly mapped plot, but how would Alice get there? And sometimes I knew where I was going, but I didn't always know exactly what my route was, and what would her take be on it, and how would she respond to that? And
right.
You have to know that character really well in order to sustain it.
Does the character, when that's happening, how long did it take you to write the book?
About 3 years.
It's a long time.
So, yeah, although for me there's always a lot of not writing in the time period, so it took over a span of 3 years.
Right.
I wasn't writing incessantly. I was thinking, I was formulating, I was also doing things like going to Debago to wander around in an abandoned cacao plantation and get the feeling of that.
Oh, I wanted to ask you about some of that stuff, too.
Yes, because there were scenes in the novel both briefly, imaginatively, in Côte d'Ivoire, on Ivory Coast, in cacao plantations, because that's somebody's story about the child slave labor there. But also, there's a whole section of the book set in Madagascar, where I've never been. At the point that I might have gone, it was the monsoon season, so I wasn't going to go. It's not recommended. But I did that kind of reading and thinking and again, the travel to Tobago, just to smell it and taste it and wander in a little rainforest with, seeing chocolate growing on trees is an incredibly valuable experience.
Yeah.
The pods, they look like squash at a glance, but they grow like cartoon trees. They just grow directly off the trunks. It would be like seeing, hard shell sort of autumnal New England squash growing off directly off the trunks at a right angle from palm trees. I mean, it's a really crazy looking plant. It looks like something in the background of Crazy Cat.
And you did a lot. I mean, there's a lot of information here about the making of candy. So you obviously did research as well.
Yes, but I have never set foot in a candy factory. I didn't want to set foot in a candy factory past a certain point because I really didn't want anyone to be able to even begin to think I was writing about a specific candy factory.
So this is not based on anybody.
It's not based on anything.
I know for a fact that there is no candy factory on River Street and James in New Haven. So
no, that building would be kind of near by the Bigelow Boiler Factory.
Right.
But it's that region. And in fact, imaginatively, the factory I gave Eli Zaplinsky was the failed family business that I actually have discovered. I didn't know it. I grew up in New York City. I've been in the New Haven area for 33 years, but it's not my hometown. It is my hometown now in a certain way. But my great-grandfather ran a family business in New Haven that actually was situated about where the Schartenberg building has been more recently on that corner, but it was a factory making a product called the one-lock adjustable reamer. I don't really know whether this was an innovation because other reamers weren't adjustable or had more locks.
I don't know.
One lock is a good, better than none or better than
right.
six. You know, I don't know. But he was a music critic by trade. His name was Samuel Swift. He wrote for various New York newspapers about chamber music and opera. He was also a little bit of an art critic. And because of deaths in a family, which so often affects the future of a family business, he ended up with responsibilities that were totally unsuited to him. And so he would leave New York City every morning at, 4 in the morning, take a train to New Haven, either walk up State Street or take a trolley, run this factory making the one-lock adjustable reamer, apparently very badly, go back to New York, go directly to hear opera or chamber music, go to the newspaper, write his review, go home, sleep 4 hours, get up, do it again. And he died in his early 40s.
No, I can see why.
Worn out completely by this. Also, I think he had appendicitis, which was sort of the end of you in 1914. The family business went out of business. And so the factory, with its abandoned equipment and this failed device, I appropriated and moved to a different part of New Haven and gave it to Eli Zaplinsky because he's the scavenger and he can reuse some of the equipment and use the building and make a factory to make candy.
Well, there's this there is a great scene in the book which I think is wonderful where you talk about when they built the equipment out of, you know, they're reusing equipment that had nothing to do with making candy.
Which is often the case in the early part of the 20th century. These innovators would come along and patch together, you know, sort of truly Rube Goldberg kinds of equipment to make things. And, you know, you think of someone like Sam Born, who came to America from Russia. First thing he invents is a machine to put sticks into lollipops. And he makes the first automated lollipop stick inserting machine. Then he invents the chocolate coating on Klondike bars, which, of course, we all know from Good Humors or those little Dove things. I mean, you know, but he was the man who invented the process for that. And then he invented a machine which those of us who grew up in the Northeast have a name for the product it made. The little chocolate sprinkles on ice cream you would call... No, that's
Some
not New England.
Shots.
What else do they call them?
Sprinkles.
What else?
I don't even know.
Jimmies,
that's right.
And why are they called Jimmies? Because the man who ran the machine for Sam Born was named Jimmy. But Sam Born had that kind of Eli Zaplinsky, innovative, you know, I can make this out of parts, you know, sort of approach. You think, you know, it's what saved those astronauts. Was it Apollo 13?
That's right.
They can make something out of whatever there is. But that's how so many manufacturing processes, you know, were created. They were adapted. They were made from things that had originally been meant for something else.
Well, how did you figure out the recipes for the candy and the... I mean, because there is a lot of information in the book that could be real, might not be.
It's real enough. I actually operated on a lot of candy bars, a lot of what are called combination bars, and did, you know, a cross-section of a Baby Ruth, a Snickers, an O. Henry, a Butterfingers. And if you do that, you can pretty much see how they're made. You know, oh, look, the peanuts are through the nougat. Oh, look, the peanuts are obviously dropped on top after the wafer and before the chocolate coating. You know, I mean, you can see how
Although,
a candy bar is made.
But you made up, I think, some wonderful image. I think wonderful scenes where, you know, they stir the candy, whatever it is that is part of the thing that they're doing at that point. And then there's some great scene where something bad happens. And
a senile person pours the wrong ingredients into the batch table.
Right. It's wonderful.
I basically just kind of made it up and read around enough. You know, most candy factories today, you know, so many of the small brands have been taken over by the big companies, but there are a lot of good histories on websites, and I really wanted to tuck Zips Candies into that tradition, you know, that innovation, that, you know, that sense of making, you know, candy is for pleasure. Candy is fun. Candy is cheap. You know, making something cheap and sweet for the American public, you know, by people who see an opportunity, who see something new that it's never been made before. You know, the history of Lifesavers is utterly fascinating because it was Clarence Crane who made chocolate. It was a seasonal product. You know, chocolate didn't survive. It melted in hot weather. So many chocolate companies had an alternate product for hot weather. You know, today Malamars are not shipped in hot weather. There are still certain unstable candies like that. But or cookies. But Clarence Crane made peppermints in the hot weather, and he went to a pharmacy to get peppermint extract, and what did he see but a brand new device, a newfangled device to make pills, to make tablets. And he saw tablets being punched out, and the piece that was left behind was what interested him, this circle of scrap, and he had this concept of making round peppermints in this circular shape, by punch out the middle and get rid of it, and he formed them to resemble these Lifesavers, which were relatively new flotation devices on ships, and the original concept of that first product, the first flavor being Pep-O-Mint, was that it was for that stormy breath, and the graphics showed someone sort of dressed like the Gorton's fisherman tossing a lifesaver to someone drowning in what must have been a sea of halitosis, you know, for this rescue, for that stormy breath, you know, and thus the lifesaver was invented because Clarence Crane saw the possibility of a machine that was made for something else.
Well, there are great scenes like that, or great images throughout the book. And, you know, aside from the candy, I think it's safe to mention that you also have, with the Madagascar connection, there's a branch of the Zaplinsky family there that creates some of the dramatic tension in the story. So we're not going to talk about too
much
of it.
Yes, but Madagascar, you know, has fascinated me for years because of a little-known, true historic piece of World War II, piece of the Holocaust. It's the road not taken. But the Third Reich originally intended to ship all the Jews of Europe to Madagascar and create a colony, a kind of Jurassic Park for Jews on Madagascar. And they were very serious about this. They had it all planned out. They had actually stopped work on the Warsaw Ghetto and stopped transports into Poland because they were going to do this instead. But and they had full cooperation from the Vichy government, which controlled Madagascar. But they lost the Battle of Britain, and the plan depended entirely on having the British naval fleet at their disposal to ship the Jews of Europe to Madagascar. And so once that fell apart, they resumed work on the Warsaw Ghetto, they resumed transports into Poland, and the Madagascar plan disappears from history. And most smart people who know their history have not heard of it, which fascinates me because I did not make this up.
No, I was going to ask you
about
that.
I did not make this up. If I were to write a book about the Madagascar plan, which I'm not going to do because I'm a novelist and it's very hard for me to stick to the facts for too long, they tend to get in the way of a good story in the end, but not always. I know what the title would be. The Madagascar plan would be The First Solution.
Yeah.
But in my novel, Julius Zaplinsky, the younger brother of Eli in New Haven, gets wind of the Madagascar plan. He's living in the Jewish part of Budapest. The war is cranking on. The Jews of Budapest managed to hang on later than Jews in many other European cities, but you know, the end was near. He finds out about the Madagascar plan and gets himself to Madagascar to get in on the ground floor, to get there first, you know, buy land, get established. And there he is waiting for all the other millions of Jews of Europe to show up. But, of course, nobody ever does.
It was one, I thought, for me, that was just a poignant scene. And I loved that whole kind of side story. And you have many side stories in this book, but that one was the one that just captivated me. It was beautiful.
Thank you. The novel is made of many, many different ingredients. And in some ways, I suppose I've made, you know, something that's a lot like a tricky combination candy bar with many different ingredients, where this is sticky and that is crunchy and this is salty and that is smooth, and, you know, and
well, it's a true confection.
It is a true confection of a novel in that sense, which is not for every reader, because
no book is.
No book is. This is a novel that depends on this singular voice. She's telling the story. She's telling her imagined history for Julia Zaplinsky on Madagascar. I mean, she is. It is always her voice. But it's also a novel made up of many parts, many things that will eventually connect. And there are readers who like something that's more direct and plainer. You know, there are always the people who just want a nice, you know, plain caramel, one flavor.
Yeah. Well, this one is a beautiful book, and I really want to thank you for talking to me today. This is David Wilk for Writer's Cast. I've been talking to Catherine Weber, whose new book is True Confections, which I highly recommend to all.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.